Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And it's my pleasure to introduce myself as the speaker tonight. I'll be speaking about transcending cruelty. This is my annual lecture here at the club. And I picked tonight's topic because I think it's a very significantly different way of looking at a problem that has gone on for a long time in human life. And I'm not here to complain about cruelty. I'm not here even to reform cruelty. I'm here to explain it. And by the end of my lecture, you'll understand why I just say I want to explain things and not reform them and not change them necessarily. But if you explain it clearly enough, everybody has the chance to decide whether they like it or not. So I should admit, of course, that I am a reformed reformer. I used to be a reformer. When I was in college, I learned meditation, and I started to teach for Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Those of you who are old enough to know the Beatles know who he is. And I taught in a lot of places. One of the places I taught was in Hong Kong. I was 21 years old. And a friend of mine who happens to be here and I were teaching there. And we went someplace, and it was a very bad neighborhood in Hong Kong, to give a lecture. And on the way there, I was thinking about something that Maharishi's organization had just stated to all of us, which was, you know, this is a pretty big task to reform the whole human race. And to get everybody to meditate and become better people and so on and so forth. So we have a new way of looking at this. If we just teach 1% of all the people, everybody else will change automatically. And I remember thinking, right. I was very skeptical about this. And in addition to being skeptical about it, I also thought that would violate all their free wills. Right? Because if they didn't really want to go along with this change, and they were being moved around, behaving themselves well, but they really didn't want to, that would be kind of a mess, a bigger mess actually than we already have. So it made me think from a different angle on the whole thing. And I also thought some other things that day, which I'll share with you. I thought to myself, well, okay, so you might be wrong to be skeptical. It might work that way. We might actually get 1% of the people to start, then the whole change will take place. But then what? And I thought, well, you know, what would be next? Maybe we would have to go out and teach all the tigers to be vegetarians. And I thought, well, that would take a while. And then, because we lived in Hong Kong, the next thought that occurred to me is, well, then we'd have to teach all the cockroaches that cleanliness is next to godliness. And I thought, now that would take even longer. And we had a lot of cockroaches in our apartment in Hong Kong. And as much cleanliness as we could make, but not enough. So in looking at it that way, I thought, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the approach. Maybe the main idea was free will. Main idea was free will. You violate other people's free will in going around and trying to reform them. As Mark Twain said, you know, it's much easier to reform other people's bad habits than your own. So from that point of view, I would also like to say about this reformist zeal that if you have that kind of reformist zeal, I'll explain a little bit later why it doesn't really get the goal that you're looking for. So, cruelty. Why have I picked cruelty? Basically, when people want to eliminate something from human life, they have a big category. It's called evil, right? So let's get rid of evil from life. So I haven't done that. Why didn't I do that? Because I don't think evil is actually a very useful term. Those of you who have heard me before, I take some concepts, I throw them out. I say, I know this is a concept that's been used for thousands of years, but it's not clear enough. It's not useful enough. It's too amorphous. And I'll explain why I think that the concepts of both good and evil are not very good. So you take humanity and you take our personalities and make a bell curve out of it. That's popular this last century. So there's a bell curve of all the human personalities, right? When people ask the question about whether human beings are good or evil, there's a lot of different answers. A lot of different answers. And I found that you could actually put the pattern of the answers into that bell curve. So in that bell curve, We have the bulk of humanity in you know, the average human being in that bulk of the bell curve. And over at the far end over here, we have psychopaths and sociopaths, even high-functioning ones. And over on the other end, we have maybe all the great artists, all the great scientists, all the great religious leaders, all the great authors, and so on. They're all over on this other end. And in the middle is everybody else. Now, if you ask the psychopaths and the sociopaths, if you ask them what they think of humanity, what do they say? They say, human beings are too good for their own good. This is a dog-eat-dog world, and they don't know it. They don't know how to behave. They don't know how to survive. This is, they're ridiculously good. Now, if you ask an average person right in the middle of the bell curve, what do they think of human beings? They say, people are good. They're kind of bad sometimes, but not too often. They're a little naughty, but not. Basically, people are good, just like me. And that's what they say. And if you ask all the religious leaders and all the top scientists and everything, what do they say? Impossibly incorrigible. Don't know what they're doing. Don't know how to live their lives. I need a 12-step program for one. I need a 10-step program for another. We need to reform the human race. Now, why is that? It's because of where you stand on the curve. If you're over at this end, you look at the curve and it's all behind you. If you're over on this end, you look at this way and it's all ahead of you. So if you're right in the middle, it looks just fine. And it's just like hot and cold. It's a relative term, good and evil. Hot and cold, we call things hot and cold. And there's an objective reality to it. I'm not saying there's no objective reality, but your perception and use of that term is relative. Hot and cold, what we call hot and cold is based on the fact that we're 98.6 degrees. So, you know, in San Francisco, if you don't ever leave San Francisco, if it goes down to 40 degrees, that's cold. You know, but people in Minnesota or New York City this last winter, 40 degrees would be wonderful weather to have. Be warm. Even though they're 98.6 degrees, that's how relative it is. But in basic, you know, if our body temperature was 40 degrees, we would have a totally different viewpoint on what was hot and what was cold. So it's where you stand on the spectrum of reality that makes you choose this. And that's why I say good and evil is a relative term based on something actual. But still, it's where you stand that makes you choose as to whether something is good or evil. So let's ignore the word evil and let's not deal with it. Let's talk about one particular part of it, the one that drives us the most crazy, actually, and that's cruelty. Why does cruelty bother us the most? What are the elements of cruelty? Okay. So the elements of cruelty are that it's a desire. It's a desire like any other desire. All desires are designed to make us happy. And people desire to be cruel in order to be happy. But what do they do in order to do? What is the element of cruelty that makes it distinct from other desires? It is the desire to cause another person pain. So they are getting pleasure from your pain if it's trying to do you. That's what cruelty is. That's why we don't like it. Because, you know, who wants to be put into pain to satisfy somebody else's desires? So that's the elements of cruelty, the desire to make somebody else experience pain. Now, why did we ever get into that? How did that ever start in human life? What are the reasons why it's such a popular way to try to become happy? Because by the time I'm done with this lecture, you'll say, why did we ever do that? It's not in our self-interest. It's not in our self-interest, and I'll make that as clear as I can. There are reasons why. And it's fundamental to the way we live our life anyway. So, what are the reasons why we've gotten into cruelty? First thing is, it's naughty. To be cruel is naughty. And that's always attractive. Mark Twain said, Adam was only human. He didn't want the apple for its own sake. He only wanted it because it was forbidden. The mistake lay in not forbidding him to eat the snake. Now, not only is that interesting about cruelty, but, you know, That's about the shortest version of undercutting the Adam and Eve story that I've ever read. Because it's very clear that if we had been forbidden to eat the snake, nothing would have happened. We would have never left paradise, right? Because the snake would have been gone. And the apple would still be there. So the interesting thing about that, too, is that if we had forbidden being kind to other people, that probably would be much more popular now than otherwise. And why is that? Because our free will our free will rejects rules. It doesn't reject them all the time, but in general, we get a lot of pleasure out of breaking rules, because that's what free will is like. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about free will later, but free will is the part of our lives, the part of our way of looking at things, that makes us want to break rules. There's another thing that's involved as well, and that is part of our culture has told us from the time that we were children, and this is true of all human cultures. It might just be to get children to behave. It might be something more fundamental than that. But we've all been told that there's some very nasty characters out there in the world that are trying to get us to be naughty, and that we don't listen to them. We shouldn't listen to them, and they're actually begging you to be naughty. You know, Satan and his minions, all those guys, you know. They're out there begging you to be naughty. That makes you feel very important. Right? Because there's these really important big people who are begging you to do something. That's exactly how you're made to feel important. And in being made to feel important, it's very important. It's very important to feel important. And so one of the keys to understanding how to overcome cruelty is to understand this concept I call the importance of being important. So what's involved in the importance of being important? Well, it's so universal, it's very hard to pinpoint in some ways. But we do it all the time. I worked in New York, worked for a partner in a law firm. I won't give his name to protect the guilty. And I'd been working with him for about 2 months or something like that, and I was in front of his desk, and he picked up the phone. He wanted to get the tax lawyer in to talk to us about something. Picked up the phone and called him. And it was back in the old days when things got routed through the receptionist and all kinds of things like that. But anyway, he called. It didn't get through to the tax partner. It bounced out to the receptionist. And so he says to the receptionist very quickly, he says, "Tell Dick I called, you know, leave him a message." And she said, "Dick who?" And of course, she should know this because it bounced from his number. But anyway, she said, "Dick who?" He said, "Dick Keefe." And then she said, "Okay, who are you?" And he said, "Who am I?" He says, "Yeah, who are you? I have to make the message clear." And he just slammed down the phone. Didn't give her the name. And he said to me, "I've been here 27 years. How could she not know who I am?" And I said, "Yeah, John, you've been there 27 years, but she started last week." And it's just the way people feel. You know, they feel, "I'm so important." In fact, happened the other day. I was at a meeting with a bunch of political leaders, local political leaders. Again, I won't give the name. And the woman who was handing out the name tags told me this afterwards. One of the local political leaders, she handed him his name tag. He says, "I don't need that." And she said, "Well, you know, it's helpful for people to you know, call you by name and so on. Everybody has a name tag." He said, "Well, I don't need that. Everyone knows who I am." And she said, "Everyone?" He said, "Well, if anyone doesn't know who I am, they should not be here." And you're absolutely serious, absolutely serious. This is also a sign of importance. One of the things about this, you know, attempt to be important that I find very interesting is very, very common. And I call it the two-year-old approach to attention. So when you're 2 years old, you come in the room, your parents are all delighted to see you, everyone claps, whatever you do, you know, "I can walk, look, I can walk, I can talk," you know, and everybody's cheering you on, all your relatives are. And there are some people who don't ever get over that. You know, some go to Hollywood, and some go to Washington, D.C. Depends upon how good looking they are. That's what I've been told, how that gets sorted out. But it's really quite true that most people are quite used to the idea of walking into the room and not everybody's head's turning. But other people, you know, it would be very disappointing for them to walk in a room and not have everybody's heads turned because they're used to that experience. That's also part of the importance of being important. But on a daily basis, everybody does it a little bit, a little bit. And that's because of something very fundamental, which I'll talk about, and I'll say, how do you solve that problem? Because that problem is what we use in our cruelty. When we are suffering, we need to make other people around us suffer even more in order to be more important than they are. And that's why even a good husband who's been good for 25 years, loses his job, goes home, and beats on his wife. And then the wife turns around and beats on the children. Why? Because they need to make the other people around them suffer more so that they still feel they're in the same hierarchical position that they were in before. That's the importance of being important. It will make us be cruel to the people we love and who we cherish and who we even want to be as happy as possible. And so this importance of being important is such a fundamental thing, it underlies almost everything that we do. So, now, that's how we got into it. Those are the elements of how we get into it. Now, what's interesting is, what can we do about it? Well, there's a solution. The first thing is to recognize that we have free will and that our pursuit of happiness is okay. It's not against, it's you can't avoid it no matter what you do. Anytime you think that you're not pursuing your own happiness and that you're not pursuing your own free will, you're fooling yourself. And you're fooling other people sometimes too, but you're only fooling yourself and others. And that obfuscation makes life much harder to understand. And there's absolutely nothing morally, ethically wrong with your pursuit of happiness. How intelligently you pursue your happiness causes lots of, or how unintelligent, causes lots of problems with other people. Yes, but as far as you're concerned, that's the only thing you're going to be doing anyway. You can say, for example, that you are just obeying somebody else. And you're really not pursuing your own self-interest. You're only doing what somebody else said. But you're only doing that because they promised you something that you think is going to make you happy by following those rules. Or you wouldn't be doing it. A good example is, if heaven wasn't any fun to get to, would you follow any of the rules to get there? Would you obey any of the rules to get there? Probably not. Theoretically, you think it's going to be fun, and therefore, you're willing to do it. And therefore, no matter how much you say, I'm not following my self-interest, you're always following your own self-interest. Always. It's your perception of how your self-interest is. So the first way to solve the problem of cruelty, ironically, is to admit that you're doing everything for your own happiness, the pursuit of your own happiness, that you do have free will. Now, why don't we want to admit we have free will? That's another thing. A lot of people don't want to admit they have free will. They want determinism to rule. They want no responsibility. And this is really another part of misunderstanding of things, because if you want to pretend that you don't have free will, you're doing it because, why? You're afraid of the responsibility for the results of your actions. The decisions that you've made have results, and you're afraid of taking responsibility for those. Now, why are you afraid of taking responsibility? Ironically, it's because you think you're going to get punished for doing it. Now, of course, you were punished when you were a child, probably. And this is a whole other area, and I can't go into it, it's too long, but I don't think there's any rewards or punishments in anything except for what we do to each other. But if there is this form of avoiding responsibility, it is because it makes us cruel, ironically. By trying to say that we don't have any free will, it's one of the elements that leads us to become cruel, which is one of the worst things that we do. And ironically, why it's ironic to me is because we're afraid of punishment from a divine being, essentially, and that divine being, therefore, is going to be cruel to us. We're afraid of their cruelty, so we try to pretend that it's not our fault, and then we end up being cruel to other people instead. So that's one element to it. Accept the fact that you have your free will and accept the fact that your pursuit of happiness is okay. The second element is to not desire power over other people. In the desire to have power over other people, it's another illusion. You never have any power over any other mind. Never, ever. They can always say no. You can lie about it. You can be a slave and say, be submissive to that person at all times. But those slaves are always in their minds saying no, no, no. And any time they have a chance, they can stop. Your child may obey you all the way until they're a teenager, and then they say no. I mean, they say no when they're two, and then they kind of get over that because you make them get over that. And then eventually they become teenagers and realize they can say no again, and then they're back to saying no. So there is no reality to the power over any other person at any time, not political, not any other time. It would take a long time to give 100 examples, but I think it's pretty clear. There's just no ever, and politically, there's never, I mean, obviously, People can have control over your body. They can kill you. They can put you in jail. They can do all kinds of things to you, but they don't have control over your mind. They don't have control over your decisions. You can still make decisions inside wherever you are, whatever, however confined you are, whatever. You can make the decisions that you can make about your life, and that's what free will is. So that's the second element, to recognize that if you don't want to have power over any other person. Now, having power over things is very interesting. It's a totally different thing. They don't have minds. Things don't have minds. They don't have a will. And therefore, you can have control over them. You can manipulate them depending on your knowledge and so on and so forth. But when it comes to people, never. It's just an illusion. And it's ironic that we have that illusion. Why? We have that illusion to make ourselves feel more important than the other people. That's why we want that power. And so we get to the last part, the solution that is the most important thing, and that is the importance of being important can be solved fairly easily. We try to solve it in all these ridiculous ways, all of which are illusions. And there's one simple way to solve the problem. One, recognize that you're indispensable to yourself. Nobody else can make your decisions. Nobody else can control you. You're indispensable to yourself. That's the first thing. And therefore, and at all times, that's you. Now, the next thing is a little harder, to recognize you're not indispensable to anybody else. It's only to yourself that you're indispensable. However, instead of wanting to be more important than the other people, it can be solved very easily by saying, I want to be valuable to other people. And it's very easy to be valuable to other people. And that is, you give more than you take in any relationship. You give more than you take in any relationship, you're going to be valuable to that relationship, whether that is in an institution with a large number of people or in your personal family life or anything like that. It's not the golden rule. The golden rule is give as you'd be received. I think it's to be valuable, you give even more than you take, and you'll be just fine. You can give a lot more if you have a lot of talent. You can give just a little bit more. No problem. As long as you give more than you take, you're going to be valuable to the people around you. So the importance of being important is taken care of by two simple things that are very easy actually to do, and that will start to undercut your desire to be cruel to other people. Okay? Now, I'd like to make it perfectly clear that it's just not in your self-interest to want to have power over other people's minds. Why? Because they're going to be made more miserable by being under your thumb, and they're going to be around you. So what you've done by trying to enforce your will on other people around you, you've surrounded yourself by more miserable people. Does that really sound like a good idea? No. And so it's not in your self-interest to have that power over other people. It's not in your interest to try to be more important than other people in lots of different ways. Like you want to compete with other people because your neighbor has a Mercedes, so you want a Ferrari. You know, yes, you can drive home the Ferrari, and he says, oh, I hate that car. That Ferraris are nothing. And then all your pleasure is destroyed right there, and you've just spent a lot of money for nothing. Right? And because every one of those things in trying to be important in some physical way is an illusion. And therefore, the other mind can undercut your illusion very easily. Right? So that's the most important elements to not pursuing these things because they're just not in your self-interest. Right? Now, if we want to go back to reforming the human race, one of the great ironies of this explanation is that means there's only one really thing to focus on if you want to reform people, and that is that you want to tell people how not to be cruel. Just explain why it's not in their interest. Almost anything else you do to reform other people will not only be ineffective, it will be counterproductive. And I'll explain why. If you decide that people shouldn't have certain sexual practices, and you try to reform them from that, what you do, and if you're successful, you've suppressed their individual desires, and they become obedient to you as a result. So they're getting less pleasure because they're only obeying you and not pursuing what they wanted. Instead, they're pursuing obedience desires. And by suppressing those desires, you've made them suffer. By making them suffer, they're going to have to be crueler to the people around them. And cruelty is worse. It's more destructive and more self-destructive, a desire, than anything that has anything to do with sex. Now you talk about other things that people try to talk people out of, like not being too rich. You shouldn't be too rich. You know, the rich person, you know, it's harder for a rich person to get into heaven than to pass through the eye of a needle. Right? No, that kind of thing. Nope. It really, if we take on the rich people and say, you shouldn't own certain possessions. Now, you could explain, for example, that certain possessions are more than you need. They're actually a burden after a certain period of time, and so on and so forth. But why do we have those extra ones? Basically, to prove we're more important than other people. Right? And so we're falling for one of the illusions about this other element of it. But that's all. So people are falling for this illusions all the time. We don't have to go out and tell everybody how they're not supposed to fall for that illusion, because you'll spend all your time trying to do that. And if you just tell the people, and they won't understand it, but you tell them, you shall not be rich, then they'll obey you and say, you have something for me which is more important than being rich. I will not be rich. I'll give all my money away, and I will follow what you have to say. But what you've done is you have suppressed their desires in favor of obedience, which will make them suffer, which will make them be crueler to other people around them. In fact, if you tell people, thou shalt not be cruel, then they will suppress the desire to be cruel, become more miserable, and become even crueler than they were before. And therefore, it's not even good to try to suppress the people's being cruel. It's only useful to explain it. Explain it, and if people get it, fine. If they don't get it, there's not much you can do about it. But the desire to be cruel is deeply embedded in our society, obviously. Right? And deeply embedded. And, you know, most of the time, it's not as bad as it's been. You know, people are much friendlier than they have been in the past. People are much more confident than they have been in the past. And this is part of the reason why people aren't as cruel as they have been. And as I said, ironically, if people are to be better, it's happier. The happier they are, the happier you make the people around you, the less cruelty that will take place in your circle of friends. So, and this comes to what I also mentioned in the preliminary to this lecture. That is, you can learn how to both disarm people from being cruel to you, and you can dissuade people from being cruel to you. Those are two different things. So that's the part about it's not in your own self-interest to be cruel. Now, how do you deal with other people who see it clearly in their self-interest, because they're deluded by one of these other things, into thinking it's in their interest? How do you deal with them? Because that's even more important than not being cruel yourself, right? Right. So the first thing you can do is you can disarm people. If people are cruel, they're not usually cruel to everybody, right? They pick and choose who they're cruel to. And you can be the kind of person that makes it hard to be cruel to. You can disarm them by being charming. You can be one of the people that makes them happy. Right? And if you are one of the people that makes them happy in their life, or a little bit happier than they are, a little bit less miserable, they're unlikely to pick you as a victim of their cruelty. Unlikely. Not only, and I've given examples, but it will lessen their desire to be cruel to you. Okay? Because even unconsciously, they know that they're trying to inflict pain on you. That's what cruelty is. And if they don't want to inflict pain on you, they will not be cruel to you. Now, some very, very good people have commented on that idea and said, that's not really fair to other people. Because you're taking yourself out of the loop, and you're allowing that cruel person to then be cruel to other people. So you should martyr yourself or be a victim yourself and be the one that takes the cruelty, because you can handle it better than other people and so on. That's one of the arguments used. But that also doesn't make sense from my angle point of view, because the best thing you can do to move somebody away from cruelty is to be nice to them, to have good times with them, for them to be happier and to be less miserable. Then they're going to be less inclined to be cruel to everybody. So they'll be not cruel to you at all, but less cruel to other people as well, because you have found what can make them a little bit happier, and you have indulged in that. Now, you don't have to hang out with cruel people and then try to do this. But, you know, at work, it's pretty hard to avoid all of them, right? You know, so when you're at work, this is kind of the thing to use at work. You have a cruel boss, or you have a cruel secretary, or something like that. You can use this to dissuade them from being cruel to you. And as I said, you shouldn't worry about the other people, because you're not just, it's not a zero-sum game. Cruelty is something that is created by their misery. And they have to make other people more miserable than they are. And therefore, to the extent that you make anybody a little bit happier, you will dissuade them from being cruel, and most likely dissuade them from being cruel to you. So that's disarming. That's disarming them with charm. So the next thing is dissuading them. The more important or the more strong thing to do, and this is basically more difficult to do as well, is that people will not be cruel to you no matter how cruel they are as a person, no matter if they want to be cruel to every person around them. If they're so miserable they want to be cruel to every person around them, they will not be cruel to you if they just get frustrated by doing it, because they're looking for pleasure like in anything else. And therefore, if you do not succumb to the pain that they want you to experience, it will frustrate them. If they try to be cruel to you and you laugh it off, you laugh it off two or three times at the office, and you will find they will not come by again to be cruel to you, because this didn't work. It was only frustrating. They tried to be cruel. You didn't go delving into the pain, and so on and so forth. Right? So that's the strongest thing. That's easier to do with psychological pain than it is with physical pain, obviously. Right? But with psychological pain, if you can see through the games that are being played by other people, you can undercut their desire to be cruel by simply not getting in pain. And it is all up to your own mind and the way you react to it. Okay? Now, the second part of it is physical pain, and that's a little more complicated. It would take a long time to explain, but it's basically this. You know, if you're not afraid of death, you won't be afraid of physical pain. And if you're not afraid of physical pain, then they have no control over that as well. So that's extremely frustrating to somebody. You know, people who torture people in order to get information out of them, if the person stays, never gives them any information and takes the pain, and you know, everyone says strong will, strong will, strong will, they might just know that this is the way to get out of it the fastest. And it is the fastest way to get out of it, because they will stop doing it. It's totally ineffective. You've made what they want to do totally ineffective, and that is how you frustrate somebody who has desires that infringe upon your life. So, now that that's clear, it should only take, you know, if we take all the reformist zeal that we have for the human race, and we only do one thing, we only focus on one thing, stay on message, and we just say, explain why cruelty isn't in your self-interest to one person after another, then I can predict that there will come a time when there will be no cruelty in human culture whatsoever. And that will only take several millennia. In the meantime, you can use what I said to prevent other people from picking you as the victim, picking you as the person to unleash their cruelty on, and you can pick away at your own habits. And Mark Twain said this is about habit. This is a habit. Cruelty is one of our habits. And he said, habit is habit. He said, it is not to be flung out the window by any man, but coaxed down the stairs one step at a time. Okay? And this will be coaxing humanity one step at a time off of cruelty. But there is no, it's not in our self-interest. If we accept we're pursuing our happiness, we really could get rid of this. There are other things we couldn't get rid of, but this actually is eliminatable. So, that's what I have to say about that. Are there any questions? Go ahead.
And they could still be cruel to me. How would I prevent that?
All right. Good question. All right. Lots of elements to the answer. Lots of elements to the answer. The first thing is, pick a girlfriend who's not obviously cruel to start with. You know, it's very interesting to me, but, you know, a lot of men don't care how their girlfriend behaves. Younger men don't care how their girlfriend behaves, as long as when they're walking down the street, all the other guys imagine they're having a great time with whoever it is that they're with. And so they're willing to put up with almost anything in order to get the jealousy of the other men. Now, that's a pretty big illusion all by itself, because none of those other men really care that much. But in any case, that's the first thing. No, you can tell. Okay, so one of the things, that, to go back, is it gives me a chance to talk about another element here. Cruelty, you know, you You get happiness when you satisfy the desire to cause another person pain when you actually cause them pain. You do get happiness. But the quality of that happiness is different than the quality of other desires. This is another explanation that I've talked about at length, and I gave a lecture a couple of years ago called The Patterns in Our Personality, in which I spent some time on that. But the desire, the quality of the desire and the quality of your emotional happiness that comes from fulfilling that desire are related to each other. Okay? And that's why when someone has a cruel laugh, it sounds different than when they have a lighthearted laugh. And when they tell a cruel joke, the laughter it evokes is different in quality, in tone. You don't have to hear the joke. You can say, almost everybody can say, that was a cruel joke that was going on across the room because I can tell by the laughter. Right? And that's a good example of quality that almost everybody can understand. And so the pleasure that you get from cruelty is a different kind. That's why all the witches in the Disney movies cackle, you know, with pleasure. It's an exaggeration of this quality that I'm talking about. So the quality of the happiness that a cruel person has should be obvious to everybody if they were paying attention. And so, as I said, don't pick an extremely cruel girlfriend to start with. Okay? And the next thing is love. Love is just as straightforward as almost everything else. You know, I've talked about cruelty here. And I gave a lecture on love as well. It's all these lectures that the Commonwealth Club has been so nice to let me give over the years are on the website. You can listen to them. So I explain love in great detail. But it is the emotion caused by your attraction to your perception of beauty. It's your perception, and it's your perception of beauty. Now, beauty is the promise of happiness. Okay? And the promise of happiness you see in somebody else, that's what attracts you to them. So if you're attracted to somebody who's cruel because, you know, a lot of people, given in this whole history of human obsession with cruelty, there have been people who have developed pleasure in having people be cruel to them and inflict pain. Sadism, masochism, this kind of thing. So there are people who can turn this into pleasure. One of the ironies, too, which undercuts the whole idea of hell as well, because, you know, as I say, you can send a man to hell, but you can't make him suffer. Your mind is still in charge. So if you ever find yourself there for whatever reason, just remember that. It will help a whole lot. So in dealing with any relationship, including your girlfriend, you know, their love will increase if you continually be a source of happiness for them. If you're continually a source of misery for them, they're going to want to be more and more cruel to you. There's no question about it. They'll hate you for it. And obviously, this is why, you know, you can be in love and totally in love for 30 years and think this is the most wonderful guy in the world. And then you find out some facts that aren't so wonderful about him that you never knew about, and he says, I'd like a divorce. And suddenly he becomes nothing. And you hate him, and there's no love left at all. And this isn't because love turns into hate. Hate and love are totally different emotions. Generally, you still have some love, but you don't have any more hope that this is going to be a source of happiness for you. Now it's only going to be a source of misery for you, that person. You don't want to see him again. You want to hear the name again. You want to cut all the pictures in half and throw them all away because you just don't want to see anything anymore that reminds you of what you once thought was your hope for happiness and now you think is only a source of misery for you. So, how do you make him happy? Johnny Gray will tell you all about that. Johnny Gray speaks here too. He can talk about it. No, every person is different. Every person is different. And how you can tell another person's personality is by their passions and their fears. Their passions are what they believe deeply, deeply, deeply will make them happy. And their fears are what they believe deeply, deeply will make them unhappy. And that's the easiest way to read other people's personality, their passions and their fears. And if you know what their passions are, satisfy their passions. And if you know what their fears are, help them avoid their fears. It's that simple. It's not very simple. That's the simple principle. That's a simple principle, but you have to practice it in a way. Because most of the time, when we're dealing with other people, we're dealing with the image we have of them in our own minds to satisfy our own desires. We're not really dealing with them as individuals. And this is another illusion that gets in our way. You know, I've spoken about this before plenty of times. A lot of people are very afraid of public speaking. And the reason, there's a very simple reason for it. People are, there was a one survey that was done maybe 20 years ago. What are you most afraid of? And more people were afraid of public speaking than dying. It's the highest thing on the scale for being afraid of it. And why? Because while I'm public speaking or anyone's public speaking, all the audience is looking at you saying, that was a stupid thing to say. You know, you should have more hair on top. You know, do you really have bifocals? How long have you had those? And that kind of thing. And so, you know, if you're at all sensitive as a person to what's going on in everybody else's mind, the more people that are doing this, the more uncomfortable you get in front of them. Right? So maybe you can do it in front of 3 or 4 people, but once it gets past 10, you can't handle it anymore. Whereas, you know, I'm used to doing this, and the reason is because I know you're all thinking those thoughts, and I don't mind. Yes, Gary?
In my head, fear is the basis for most human dysfunctionality. That's not why I got up here. What okay. I got up here for was to have you discuss cruelty as a defense mechanism.
Oh, okay. Cruelty is a defense mechanism. Absolutely. You, of course, in the pursuit of your own desires, which I say is perfectly the pursuit of your own happiness, why would you be cruel to defend yourself? Easily. You see in other people their fears. If you're a master manipulator of other people, a salesman or somebody who's very successful at this kind of thing, you already know this. You deal with other people's passions and fears all the time, even if you're very unconscious about it. And if you want to move somebody away from where they're going, you manipulate their fears. Okay? Now, all I'm saying is that this method of dissuading people from being cruel to you isn't the best way, because in what you do is you end up making them more miserable than they were before. And by being more miserable, they're likely to be more cruel to you than before. Now, this is a very different point of view on the turn the other cheek from Jesus. It's a very different point of view. It's similar in outcome in some ways, but I don't think you should turn the other cheek. I think you should be very strong about it. But what I do think is that you don't need to go to fight fire with fire. No. You don't need, when they're cruel to you, you don't need to use cruelty as a defense mechanism against them. You can disarm them. You can undercut their desire to want to make you be in pain. Now, it doesn't always work. There's no 100% in anything in human life. Because some people who are very intent on being cruel can see through this. And they see right through it, and then they roll right over it. And so then you rely on whatever you do. But one of the points that I'd like to make very clear is no matter what you do, no matter whether you're cruel or not cruel or very kind or not kind, there are no punishments or rewards in store for whether you're good or bad about it or whether you're cruel or kind about it. The quality of your emotional life is always totally reflecting the quality of your desires and the quality of the way that you deal with other people. There doesn't need to be any bureaucracy to fix it afterwards. It's immediate at all times. And therefore, I've unemployed a very large contingent of people in heaven. Oh, next. Yes, go ahead.
George, I understand what you're saying as related to a spouse or a boss or a coworker, but what do you say to the child? I'm not talking about the very young child, but maybe the young teenager or teenager who is subjected to cruelty by, and not physical cruelty, even verbal cruelty by a parent.
Oh, by a parent?
Yes.
Oh, you know, I thought you were going to go to middle school. Where it's almost all
bullying
cruelty. All cruelty.
No.
I'm going to go to middle school for a second, and then I'm going to go to the parent. Okay. Why is it that most people look back on middle school as the worst time? Because people are very cruel to each other. People are all putting each other down. Why is that the period of time? That's the time of most uncertainty, least confidence that they have. They feel the most miserable themselves as they physically change. They don't know what it is. And therefore, by being in that unhappy state, they're going to want to make other people even less happy than they are so that they can keep feeling that they're doing better than the people around them. A perfect example of what I used to explain cruelty. That's why middle school is the worst. It mitigates a little bit in high school, but it goes on for all of life in some ways, depending upon the situation now. If a parent is being very cruel to a child, what do you say to the child? The first thing I think that's important is to say to them that their parent isn't God. In a sense, that their parent isn't perfect, and not only is he or she not perfect, but your life is not in his or her power. You should always feel at all times that your life is totally in your power. Now, that's hard for teenagers because we have trained them as children to be obedient. Why do teenagers rebel so much? Because they want to take back control of their own life. Right? And obviously you can't let children do whatever they want to all the time. But if you just simply recognize that the children have their own will from the time that they're born and that they want to do their own things and you treat them that way, you will find that they don't rebel as much later on. Although they will still try to create distance for themselves and get their own lives and so on, because that's what everybody will always want to do. And so by reminding them of that fact, by just letting them know that person doesn't have any control over your inner life, that's for you. That's your life. Nobody can ever get in there unless you let them in there. And if you let them in there, you can kick them out in 2 seconds if you want to. This is also true for people who are caught up in cults or any other parental substitute and so on. You should say, the trick to those whole things is that they promise a reward that those people want so badly that they're willing to obey whatever, no matter how ridiculous it is. And all you have to do is say, your mind, your decision-making can never be taken away from you, ever. Nobody can ever do it. It's not possible. Because when it's gone, you're not there anymore. When your decision-making is gone, you're not there, you won't experience a thing, bingo. Nobody can take it away while you live. And however long that is, whether that's for thousands of years or millions of years or 60 years, no one can ever take that away from you. So that's the most important thing to say to a child, a teenager especially. It may seem physically that you're constrained by your parents' rules, by your parents' life, by living with your parents. You will always be somewhat constrained by whatever relationships you have, unless you want to be all alone, living all alone all the time. No. And even then, you'll go to work and you'll be constrained by that. So there's always some constraints, but there is no constraints inside your head. That's why a lot of 14-year-olds go to their rooms and stay there. They just stay in their heads, hoping to have a little bit of freedom. Yeah.
Well, this follows right up with that, because just wondering about your educational system in our society dealing with that point, especially for adolescents, if you could comment a bit more on the schools themselves as a vehicle for helping youth understand these points.
Okay, great. First of all, I think education is one of the easiest roads to shifting the human race thinking about anything, the way that we educate our children. And an overview on education, the top 2 or 3% of all the kids, usually it doesn't make almost any difference what educational system you put them into, because they're self-starters. They're going to figure it out themselves. They're going to decide which teachers to ignore and which teachers to do. And no matter what kind of system you would have, they would all make their choices by themselves. They're used to doing that, and that's what they're going to do. But the big difference you have in your whole culture is, how do you educate the next 20% of your population at the top? Because they're going to end up being all the managers and influence the businesses and the government and so on and so forth, and how do they behave? That's going to influence the way that the value of your culture, the way that you deal with everything. So obviously, I think free will is understated as a crucial thing in life. And that, you know, because I think that the more you demonize free will, the more that you put it down, the more it will come out in ways that are cruel. And as I said, I think cruelty is the worst thing that we do to each other. It's certainly the most undercutting of our happiness, because it's designed directly to destroy your happiness. And so free will is crucial. But let me say one more thing about free will. That's a whole long discussion all by itself. But by free will, I don't mean unrestricted free will. Obviously, free will is restricted. You can't do certain things. You can't fly. You've got a body, that kind of thing. So, and people often say, well, it's a moral decision. Free will is a moral issue. Free will is not a moral issue to me at all. Free will is, do you make decisions or do you not make decisions? Anything that makes decisions is a mind. All minds have free will. They make decisions. That's what it is. So any mind that makes any decision has the same free will that I'm talking about. So it seems to me that we because we ask of other people to conform to our images of them, we do this with our children very strongly. And so we educate them to try to turn them into the kind of people we want, which is why there's so many fights in the educational system, because different groups of people have a different idea about how those children should be molded, right? So I feel right now in the educational system is very good in the United States for the top 50% of our population. It's a very good public educational system. Unfortunately, we fail the bottom half quite a bit, especially the bottom quarter. And in particular, that is because their parents don't value education, and therefore you have to do something to kind of overcome that without ruining their family life by telling them that they have to be different than their parents. So it's kind of a very, very complicated issue to deal with. But at the same time, the other big issue that I see is a lot of boys could probably use playing on the playground, 6 hours a day and only 2 hours in the classroom until they're about 10 years old or 11 years old. I think they'd be much less disruptive in the classroom, and they would probably learn, as soon as they start learning their reading and math and stuff like that, they would learn it all in fifth and sixth grade in no time at all, and they'd be caught right up to everybody else. And then they wouldn't be so miserable so much of the time, and they wouldn't be cruel to all the other kids and so on. That all drips down all the time. And it's true for some girls too, but it's particularly true of boys right now because people want the boys to behave themselves in class. I mean, I was educated by Catholic nuns. There was no question about behaving at all. They had 40 to 50 kids in the classroom, so there's a lot more leniency now, and that also causes more disruption, so on.
Well, this question kind of slides into everything that we just talked about, but so bullying is a big issue now, especially in the younger grades. And I agree with what you said before, but I don't think, or what would you say to younger children who the approach is to being you're in your own power and that sort of thing. So,
right.
Question. Okay.
Okay. Well, the first thing is, we do a lot of things in life for other people to think a certain way about us. We create an image, we present it to the world, and the kids are all doing the same thing too. They want the other kids to think of them a certain way. And the kids don't think of them that way, they're unhappy about it. Okay? Now, the bullies are the ones that are the most miserable most of the time. And so they probably are being hurt someplace else, at home or some other place, and then they want to make somebody else more miserable than that. Unfortunately, they almost always pick on the kids who are most vulnerable because they can sense it, they can sense the fear. And this is true for almost all animal behavior that anybody has ever studied. And so what we're trying to do is something different than any other animal has tried. So I think we have to have that perspective on it when we're trying to change something. At the same time, I think that it can be done. As I said, I think that cruelty can be eliminated, but I think that the long-term way to do it is simply to say, this is not in your self-interest.
What do you say to the child who's being bullied?
And the child who's being bullied, you say, that child's opinion of you is irrelevant. That child's perception of you is irrelevant. It's not important in your life. Most of the time, people who are bullied, what they basically want is they want other people to tell them that they're very loved, that they're not worthless, that they're not somebody to be beat up, right? And that's not, I mean, obviously they're still going to be beat up. What did my dad's generation do? They took boxing lessons, and they went back and beat the other kids up. And it worked very well. It stopped the bullies. That's a story I won't get into. But, I don't have anything against that way of doing it. I don't think that that's long term because, you beat up the bully is now even more miserable because he now feels even smaller than before. And so, it's a downward cycle. On the other hand, I don't think that you should accept people's bad behavior. I'm all in favor of figuring out how to push people away from being bad to you too. And with children, it's very, very difficult because they're not old enough, wise enough, most adults aren't, to figure out how to push back on bullies in a very successful way. And it's because especially the children who get the bullying are the ones who already have a lot of self-doubt anyway. And so you have to build that up. And I don't think telling, you know, handing out ribbons to everybody in every race is the way that self-esteem is built up, because very soon everyone knows that doesn't mean anything because everybody gets one. So that's a nice attempt somebody made to try to do the same thing. It doesn't work. I think we need to be very honest about it and then say, but don't tell the child that you're being victimized because of your own weaknesses. That's not a good idea. But it is to take the child and say, you know, how does so-and-so deal with it? He never gets bullied. He never gets bullied. Why? But people feel, especially victims of bullies, they cry a lot. They're very upset. If you don't cry, it's the same thing that I said about cruelty before. If you don't give the cruel person what they want, and what the cruel person wants is your pain, if you don't give it to him, he's going to go someplace else. So if you tell the child, do your best to not cry till you get home, or do your best to not cry in front of the bully. You know, if you want to fight him back, that's one thing. If you want to spit on him, that's another thing. If you want to laugh in his face, that's even better. It's hard for the kids to do that. But some of them can hold back on their crying until they're out of sight of the bully. And then let them bawl all they want to. No. But that helps, because the bully wants to see the cry. Yeah.
You talked a lot, you know, about things on an individual level. I'm thinking in terms of international relations, aka Syria, for example.
Right.
Can we reduce our military budget, for example, by implementing some of your ideas?
Not for several millennia.
Okay.
But, no, in international politics, you know, it's been said, you know, I mean, you have the best weapons, you're in a good situation. That's physical weapons. If you have the best psychological weapons, you're in a good position. That's individual. So these are the psychological weapons for dealing with it. I'd love to talk about Syria, actually. Just for one second anyway. Because how many noticed when Obama, you know, put the red line down, said, if you use chemical weapons, we're going to stop you. Right? Now, when he did that, what happened? About 6 months later, Assad tested that red line. Now, it was a long time afterwards. Why would Assad do such a thing? Assad would only do that if he was being forced to do it, because it's not going to do him any good. Because he's already in trouble with everybody. The only reason he could do that is because he must have been trying to make one of his important supporters happy. Who's his important supporter he would want to make happy? Putin. Why would Putin want that tested? Because he wanted to see what kind of a man Obama was. And he found out.
Relationship between trauma and cruelty?
Trauma and cruelty, yeah. The connection between trauma and cruelty is what I was saying. That is, the more misery that you're in, you have to try to, in order to feel, you're in a spectrum, and you feel that you are in the top 60% of people, and you look around, you see 40% of people are ahead of me and 60% are behind me, and you're comfortable with that, you've gotten comfortable with that. And then you have a trauma, you have something that makes you miserable, and you suddenly feel that you've dropped down like this. You have to make everybody else that's around you drop down in the same way. So I want to say one good thing about all the trauma that's going on from the wars over the last couple of things. People were traumatized by World War I. They were traumatized by World War II. They seem to be increasingly traumatized more and more and more. And unfortunately, I would say that's because we are advancing in terms of how we think about not killing other people. That this is something outside of what we should be doing. People took it for granted for a long time, and people have been moving away from it. And as a result of moving away from it, those who are forced to do it, I think, are actually more traumatized than they would be otherwise. And that actually, unfortunately, for those who are traumatized, but it is a sign of our advancing civilization, in my opinion, that more and more of our soldiers are traumatized by being forced to do something that people had to do all the time before and had to live with and learn to live with. So that's one thing about the trauma, but the other is just the same thing. The more traumatized you are by something, the more you will feel that you need to push everybody down around you and traumatize them in order to feel that you're not as traumatized as those around you. Yes, Matt.
I want to start by just saying that, you know, what's validating what you just said is the number of suicides we've experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan recently. We've had more deaths by suicide than in combat.
Right.
My question is about this middle school mm-hmm. situation. It seems like such a good way of looking at this. Can you improve, can you decrease cruelty in middle school by making all these kids who want to engage in cruel behavior feel important?
Yeah. Yes, but that's tricking them too, you know, and that's been tried. And I don't know what statistics there are on how much better, how much less there is now that people try to give everybody ribbons and make them feel more important and so on. But that's a fundamental feeling of importance that usually comes from your own family and not from outside your family. Well, it comes from outside your family when you don't get it in your family, but that's a lesser form of it. Because everybody, when they walk in the door at home, is part of a very small group and an important member of that group. And we want to be valuable, as I said. You know, that's the solution, is to be valuable. But in families, often you are a valuable member, no matter whether you are the least valuable member of your family or the most valuable member of your family. Everybody's valuable to everybody else in a usual dysfunctional family. If you get really, really dysfunctional, maybe it gets worse. But the usual is at least has got that much down. It functions well for that purpose. It doesn't function for the highest purpose, which everybody really wants, which is that you want your family to accept you exactly as you are and love you exactly as you are, all warts, all problems, everything they want, every minute of every day at all times. Why do we want that? Very interesting, because we don't get it from ourselves. That's what we really want from ourselves. And so we don't get it from that, so we ask the people around us to do that. And that's why it would be very helpful to do it yourself and say, you know, no matter how good you are or how lousy you are, it's relative. And you can always say, it's like with money. You know, there's lots of people who are trying to beat their neighbor at the money game, right? But there's always Bill Gates waiting out there for you and Warren Buffett. And you're never going to get there unless you really have a great invention planned and you have another 40 years to get there. So there's always going to be a problem with your measuring yourself against other people that way. You know, if there was a God in charge of this solar system, he could feel bad that he doesn't have 3 solar systems. And that find out about somebody who's got 5 solar systems over here, you could feel just as bad then, because it's how you perceive the thing. It's not what the thing is itself. And so it seems to me everybody could just simply say, this is the way I am, and that's good enough for almost all human purposes. Look at the cockroaches. They all can eat. I mean, you can, you know, reality, you don't have to do reality TV to, you know, I mean, what's the purpose of reality TV? For you to look at the people and say, well, my life is screwed up, but they're screwed up even more than I am. And therefore, I'm more important than they are, or I'm better off than they are, that kind of thing. So, you know, if you're having trouble succeeding at that with reality TV, just, you know, switch to the cockroaches or something. You'll find something that's way, way worse than you, and you'll still feel good about yourself. It is all relative. There's always a relative point that you can find somebody way worse off than you were. And if you can't, your imagination needs a little work.
I'm thinking a little bit about human nature and kind of a competitive human nature. Do you think cruelty is a byproduct of competition between human beings?
Or absolutely.
Or do you think that's more just suffering as a byproduct, not cruelty?
There's both. You know, I think it's like, let me analogize it to sex. Because sex has got its whole thing all by itself. You know, it's a pleasurable experience all by itself. It creates children, which is very pleasurable for most people. But there's all kinds of other things that have gotten mixed in with it. Cruelty, so that's one of the things that gets mixed in with sex. You know, submissiveness, obedience, all kinds of things have been put in there with that. The same thing is true with the competition. You know, I think this is actually one of the geniuses of the capitalist system, is that it's taken all that male competitive energy and it has moved it over from violent warfare to economic warfare, which is much more productive than violent warfare. So that's another element of taking the way people are and using them better, redirecting their energy. But the competition, I think, would create the situations that would lead to cruelty, because people are competing and they lose. So they feel they're not as good and not as important as the people who won. And therefore, they feel miserable. By their misery, they have to make somebody else feel more miserable in order to compensate for that extra misery. And that might make them feel cruel. It also might make them, the next time that they fight against that guy, or the next time they compete with that guy, even economically, try to undercut the rules and be more cruel in order to win the next time. The irony of it is, if you think about it for any length of time, you'll see that anybody who cheats or lies in any competition has already admitted defeat. They don't have the confidence to compete by the rules. And therefore, they've already admitted that they're not competitive, they are defeated. So, you know, you don't need a moral rule against that. If everybody knew that, every time somebody cheated, everyone would look at them and say, what's the matter, don't you think you're up to this? That would stop it faster than any other moral rule.
I was intrigued by the title of your talk, Transcending Cruelty. And I was hoping you'd talk a little bit more about transcending, as if it was an innate quality that human beings have. And when you talk about millennia sort of absolving us of this problem, is it really possible?
Possible, yes, but it would take an awful lot of free will decisions. I really do think it's possible, because it's theoretically possible. There are some things I think can't be eliminated from human life, but I think cruelty is, because it's just one of the many desires we do in our pursuit of happiness. I don't think that you would get rid of it in the animals. You know, the tigers play with their food, cats play with their food. This is cruel behavior. They are getting pleasure from the pain of their victims. What makes humans different than other animals? Yeah. Well, we seem to be doing better. We certainly have a much more complex mating dance than all the other animals. No, but we're much more complex, I think. We have a lot of things going on that are interesting. It doesn't take that long to feed ourselves, and the rest of our time is spent on very interesting ideas. Now, but I'm going to go to the first part of your question, which was intriguing. I picked the word transcending for a lot of different reasons. One, to transcend something is to go totally beyond it. So in your personal life, you can go totally beyond cruelty. You can get rid of it in your own life. You can deflect it from other people. You can't get rid of it. But you can totally get around cruelty. You never have a cruel thought, never go by, because you can see. When you see it clearly, it's not in your self-interest. You're going to pursue getting rid of it. So once that's clear, you can get rid of it. And it's because it's not in your self-interest that it can be eliminated. If ever something is inherently in your self-interest, it will never go away from human life. But if it's only because of our delusions and our illusions that something is there, then we can get rid of it, even though it will be difficult and take time, because we have these habits. It's just not, goes on for thousands of years, it doesn't go away overnight. So I picked transcending because it really is totally getting beyond it. I picked transcending because I learned several ideas that I really liked from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he called his meditation transcendental meditation. And the meditation was to transcend beyond your mind to something bigger. I don't accept that idea. I don't think there is something bigger than your own mind waiting beyond your mind. But at the same time, I think that transcending cruelty would create the world that he was hoping for far more effectively, even though it will take a long time, than that. Now, I personally think that when you recognize that your own mind is making all the decisions, that's what happens with meditation or other things where you just turn within, you pay attention, you suddenly realize, that's me. That's my mind. What's inside, that's my mind. That's my thoughts. Those are me. And we pay so much attention to the outer world all the time that we think that that's the reality. And it is physically real. I don't think that's an illusion. But I do think that because we don't pay enough attention to the fact of who we are, that we are minds, that we have a lopsided view of all these important desires and how we want to become important, for example. We want to become important because we want to fit into this outside world in a way which is indispensable. And there is no such thing. There's no such thing. You never could be indispensable. Even though you're always indispensable to yourself, that should be enough. So there's a lot of other reasons too. But I like the word a whole lot. It was very intentional used. It's just too long to talk about it anymore. Okay, one last question.
Yeah, could you talk about the correlation between poverty and cruelty?
Yeah, absolutely. First, you know, poverty has been 80 to 90% of the human race or more for all the recorded history. And people who are powerful, we have a system now that makes those people do things in competing with each other, which creates more goods for other people. Before, they had to enforce their importance simply by crushing other people or making other people do their will. We're only a couple hundred years into an effective form of democracy. Democracy shows that individuals are becoming more important. rather than the whole group. And this is a great advance because we are only individuals. We work together. We cooperate with each other. But there is no mind of the whole group. There's only the individual minds. And the more... I'm not in favor of capitalism as per se. What I'm in favor of is that whatever system is done should not be authoritarian and centralize all the authority, because no matter how good the person is who comes in and does that, you have created a system with all the authority concentrated in one place, and who goes after that but the most ruthless people who want to prove to everybody else that they are more important than everybody else, and they have that weakness very severely, and therefore, when they get there, if they're feeling miserable about themselves, which they usually do, because otherwise they wouldn't have to prove this, they have to make everybody around them more miserable. So this isn't quite your question, but I do think that most wars and most really destructive periods in human history have come about because the vast number of people were feeling very miserable about their lives so that they could accept the idea of crushing somebody else as a way to make themselves feel better about themselves. So you can't convince a huge middle class who likes their large TV screens, you know, and their other creature comforts to go out and fight a war unless they really feel fundamentally attacked, that their whole life is going to be ripped apart and torn to shreds. So either you have to lie to them that that's about to happen, or you have to convince them that that's about to happen. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. Otherwise, the war can't be done. It can be done on the way that we do the wars now, but it can't be done on the major way. So World War I, World War II, they're both situations, especially World War II, that were caused by a great deal of misery prior to it. Because otherwise, why would people who just went through World War I do it again? No, doesn't make sense. But that wasn't your question. I hope it was good enough, because that's the end. Well, thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion.